they are out there really trying to move this issue, and that's the only reason the issue is still alive. And so I think if we have our sister unions get out there and start supporting them by giving them funds, by encouraging our members to get out there in front of 15 now, then I think we'll demonstrate to the public that we're not just talking out of both sides of our mouth. I mean, they see what's happening on TV. They see when we're able to negotiate a $15 minimum wage for union workers who are already represented. But if they hear us, if we go out there and we fight for something less, like $13.50 for them, then they're going to say, why aren't I good enough?
Thank you very much, Tina Turner Morfitt of the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists.
That was Jamie Partridge with an update on the fight for 15 here in Oregon. Thanks to Jamie, my co-host. Thanks to Daniel Parks, the engineer for Labor Radio. This is John Walsh saying thanks for listening and good night.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Halloween Community Rally and the Spirit of Unity on Saturday, October 31st at Waterfront Park in Portland. In the Spirit of Unity will be a family-friendly rally to raise the minimum wage, defend workers' rights, demand renters' rights, and support immigrants' rights. There will be trick-or-treating, costume contests, games, prizes, and music by Portland hip-hop artists. Again, that's In the Spirit of Unity, a Halloween community rally on Saturday, October 31st from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Waterfront Park, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Pipeline presents a unique perspective of the criminal justice system, addressing the root causes of crime and broadening understanding of the institution of incarceration.
Baby, you understand me now. If sometimes you see that I'm mad, don't you know no one alive can always be an angel?
Good evening. This is Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight I'll be airing audio from a performance that took place on October 18th, 2015 at the First Unitarian Church in downtown Portland. The performance was called With You on the Journey. It was the culmination of a series of writing workshops for family members of people in prison. The performance included 10 family members and 11 monologues, which told stories of having loved ones in prison. Tonight is part one, and it includes the first two monologues. The performance will be aired in segments over the next few months. I'm glad to be bringing the stories of family members to the airwaves. Our stories are powerful, but often untold. I participated in this project, and my monologue will be shared tonight. We begin our show with Carol Imani, the organizer of the project With You on the Journey, and the writing teacher. Here she is explaining how the project came to be and introducing the performance.
Hello. My name is Carol Imani, and at the beginning of this year, I was lucky enough to receive a grant from the Regional Arts and Cultural Council here in Portland to do this project. The idea was to find people who have family members in prison and who would like to explore that experience in writing, and then read aloud what they'd written in a public performance. I thought there would be lots of people wanting to do this, and that it would be a challenge to choose from among all the great candidates banging on my door for a chance to participate. I was naive. Although I advertised the opportunity widely, no banging on my door happened over the 6 months it took to find the 9 people who will be reading you their stories today. But one by one they appeared, and every time another one did, I felt grateful. Just imagine, someone in your family is in prison and you can hardly bear to discuss it with your best friend or even yourself. It's too painful. It's shameful. Or at least that's how it is often regarded. It makes you feel miserable and angry and overwhelmed. So now, not only are you going to explore in writing all of the difficult feelings involved, confronting what you're going through in all of its bewildering complexity, but you are going to stand up in front of a room full of strangers and read it aloud. So I think the fact that this is happening at all is a kind of miracle. Before we start, I'd like to thank the First Unitarian Church for donating the space for our workshops and this beautiful chapel for our performance today. A special thanks to Kate Lohr, the Minister of Social Justice here at the church, who has encouraged me and supported the project every step of the way. I want to also thank the Social Action Group at the church, Ending the New Jim Crow, Healing Our Justice System, which has helped out in many ways. Thank you so much for coming today. And now I invite you on a journey through 10 heartfelt, powerful stories, courageously told.
Hello again, I'm Chris Karshmar, and I'll be introducing the monologues today. Amy, our first reader, will be telling you about a recent visit to her brother, who is at a prison in upstate New York. And Neil, our second reader, will also be telling you about a visit to his foster son in jail.
Hello, everyone. I hope that the story of my visit gives you a glimpse not just into the difficult emotions that I have faced, but also into the experiences and hurdles that family members have to face to visit their loved ones. My brother Douglas is 30 and is incarcerated at a medium security prison in upstate New York. He and my family are in the 7th year of his 10-year sentence. Doug's sentence began in 2008, but his run-ins with the law began about 5 years earlier when he was suspended from high school after a small amount of marijuana was discovered in a wallet he left on the school bus. I have visited him in 6 different prisons and 1 drug rehab center in the last 9 years, and the entire process has been highly emotional for me. My brother was my earliest role model and friend. He is 2 years older, and though we grew apart during adolescence, in part because of his drug use, he has an important place in my heart. His crime occurred while he was blacked out, and his victim was his best friend, who was also blacked out. So I'm confused about what actually happened. I do know he was guilty of driving while intoxicated, but I don't know whether he is guilty of the crime for which he is serving time, assault in the first degree. My brother was coerced by the police while they were interviewing him. He told them repeatedly that his lawyer wasn't present to make a statement. When the police gave him a Miranda rights waiver card to waive his right to remain silent, he pushed it away again and again as they pushed it back. To pressure him to speak, the police told him his friend was dead, which was a lie. Late at night, emotions swirling from the lie and still totally drunk, he gave testimony. Another person was in the car with my brother that evening when he was arrested, but the police never even interviewed him. And tragically, by the time of the trial a year later, that person had died of an overdose. Why didn't the police's conduct seem to matter to the judge and the jury during the trial? There are so many things I'd like to know about how my brother was sentenced to 10 years in prison at 23 years old. Technically, he was an adult, but neuroscience tells us brains don't fully develop until 25, and I believe he still had the impulsiveness of a younger mind. I've battled all kinds of intense emotions, like sorrow, isolation, confusion, fear, and anger. At times, my anger has been so frequent and fierce that my body has been racked with pain, and I have literally hit my head against walls and screamed in empty rooms. The anger has been so intense in part because I feel guilty about having been unable to create a different outcome in the courts or to have prevented my brother from spiraling into using drugs to self-medicate for depression in the first place. Using drugs caused him to lose motivation to do anything else. The first night I visited him in our town jail in 2006, he told me his only goal in life was to make it till 21 and then drink himself to death. He was shackled to the bed that night since he was seen as a suicide risk. And I was left to wonder how it is that our society, schools, families, and communities allow our children to get to the point that suicide seems the only way out. And why was it incarceration and run-ins with the law that stopped my brother? And might they eventually cause it? I got a call about my brother's arrest from my father early one morning while I was studying abroad in China. I was shaken and had trouble finishing my schoolwork that semester. When I returned home a few months later, none of my friends asked what had happened, even though they all knew. That summer, I lived in fear being in the same town as the victim who I had heard threatened to shoot my brother the year before. Our families have been court-ordered not to speak, and this ban on reconciliation caused my fears to fester. To deal with my pain, I turned to yoga and meditation and spent years avoiding drugs and alcohol of any kind, compelled to be a role model for my brother, someone he respects, who doesn't need them to have a good time. My last visit took place in July when I made a sudden trip home for a memorial service of a family friend. On the weekend of my trip, Sunday was the day for the visits and also the day of the memorial service. My brother is in a facility that only allows visits on alternate weekend days, but my mother found out I could request to visit on Saturday instead. So I called the prison on the Monday before my visit and put in the request. After days of gut-crushing anxiety that the arbitrariness of prison rules would prevent my visit, I called the prison hours before my flight and found out that my request was lost. But luckily, in the end, they did still grant it. During my trip to New York, I was hoping to have ample time to see my family and friends, who I rarely visit. But I didn't get to do much of that, because I spent 30 hours of the 78-hour trip to drive through the wilderness of upstate New York to the border of Canada and back, so I could visit Doug. That's how much I miss him. In New York and many other states, prisons are built in rural communities far from major cities. In New York, those counties rely on the jails and the prisons for income. My brother is housed 6 hours from our home. Gas and a night's stay in a motel cost me $150. When I arrived on the morning of my visit at 7:30 a.m., the room was full of people who had arrived on a bus from New York City. They had traveled all night with others visiting this and nearby jails. I was nervous that something would go wrong, even with my letter from the superintendent in hand and an outfit I thought would be foolproof. The enforcement of the clothing directive from the state is arbitrary, and it varies from prison to prison and guard to guard. It has not changed since 1993. On a previous visit, after waiting over an hour to be processed, at the final processing step, I was told I needed to change into pants with pockets. Mind you, I had been wearing the same pants without pockets for 6 years to visit my brother. Since they wouldn't let me wear those pants, I had to drive with my mother, younger brother, to town, and we bought a new pair. On my visit in July, processing took 3 hours. I saw several women and children turned away for not wearing the right clothes and then scrambling to get something so they could visit. This treatment of family visitors is what makes processing take so long. It's not because of lack of effort from the families. It seems to be deliberate on the part of the staff. One woman visiting from the city had gone early to town in the morning to purchase acceptable clothes so her daughters would be allowed in. But when she was finally processed a few hours later, she was told that her daughter could not wear the long shorts which she had just purchased for the visit. I'm not sure how they had gotten to town since they were in a remote rural area, far from passing taxis and friends, but needless to say, she was disturbed and distraught when her daughter was denied. In the end, another visitor lent the girl a pair of pants, so they were able to visit. This made me remember times in another facility when I witnessed rivets on people's pants setting off the metal detector, and how they would take knives and scissors to perfectly good clothes just so they could visit. These types of encounters have always infuriated me because they create long, costly, and needless hurdles for visitors. And most families who have a loved one in prison are facing poverty and have to travel hours on end for a visit. When I was finally processed, I was informed that the change purse my parents had brought just a week earlier was now considered too big. So the guards transferred my change and dollar bills into a brown paper bag, the kind that's usually reserved for bras that set off the metal detector. When this happens, women have to go into the bathroom, take off their bras, come out with it in a bag, which they give to the officer, walk through the metal detector without it going off. At that point, they could put their bra back on. Seeing my brother was a joy, and I got to spend 3 hours talking with him. Although when he arrived, I was crying from the hostility and lunacy that he faces every day, he made me laugh so we could just enjoy our time together. He told me he thinks he has enough good time, which is without violations, to get out at his earliest possible release date, which is a year from now. I told him about the radio show I had been working on and updated him on my yoga teaching. He told me about the books he's been reading and how he and a few of his other dorm mates, there are 60 men in a dorm, work in the library and help each other to always have something to read. He encouraged me to keep up my work with the radio show and teaching yoga. Apparently, lots of the guys in his dorm are growing their hair out, so he decided to try it. We took this picture together with our hair down. This is the longest he's ever had it. And a letter he sent me last week, he asked me if I was going to make up some crazy story about fights breaking out in the visiting room or to just tell you how it is. We have to eat bad food out of vending machines, and that food is sadly better than anything they're served while we sit in a room with far too many people in it. I do have one crazy visiting room story. At Clinton Correctional Facility, the fire alarm went off one time. For about a minute, the visitors and the inmates were looking at the guards expectantly, and their expressions never changed. They never acknowledged the situation. And none of us asked questions. We were too afraid. And I just have to wonder how often my brother is put into danger because of this kind of callousness. I love my brother, and I'm glad that Doug will be getting out somewhat shortly. But I'm concerned about whether he will make it, because the years he should have been building a career were taken from him by the state.
You are listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland. I'm Amy Johnson. Tonight I'm airing audio from a performance called With You on the Journey, Families of People in Prison Tell Their Stories. This is part one. Tonight's monologues tell stories of visiting loved ones in prison. Next is Neil.
Queuing up. It was visiting day. It was my first time behind these bars, the cold cement walls and heavy steel doors. I was part of a long line from the parking lot to the first set of doors and the guard behind the glassed-in reception area. Signs in the parking lot and on the wall warned me to leave most everything in the car. My coat, cell phone, my wallet. Just keep one car key and my driver's license. The guard's first question was what was my son's number? His inmate number. Not his name, not who I was, but his number. I was on the visiting list, and the guard motioned me to stand on the other side of the white line on the floor and wait with the other family members who had come here today to see their sons, brothers, and husbands. No one smiled. No one looked at anyone. A guy made a joke about bringing in drugs, but no one laughed. We fidgeted, the precious hour and a half set aside for visits today ticking away. A buzzer rang, and we shuffled through a sliding wire gate and down a cement and linoleum hall to another gate. The first gate clanged shut behind us, and then the next gate slowly slid open. "Go find your inmate and pick up the phone there," a guard intoned. He glared at each one of us as we walked by. I felt naked and ashameful. I was guilty of something, like having a son in jail. We entered a large room, a maze of cement wall blocks and thick glass, metal stools, and phones connected to the wall with steel cables. Through all the glass windows, I could see a long divider made with gray steel bars, with more cement walls and bars behind that. There were no windows to the outside. We had left the real world. The air was stale, thick, and lifeless in my nose. It smelled of disinfectant and stale sweat. I wandered around, hoping I'd recognize him, seeing other inmates smiling and waving to their families who were already engrossed in their phone conversations. Finally, I spotted him, found my stool, and picked up the phone. "Hi." "Hi." He gave me a big grin and then frowned, looking down. "I'm sorry. Sorry you have to see me like this. Sorry I've disappointed you," he said. "I'm sorry too," I said, "but I love you. I came here today to tell you that." He nodded, blinking back a tear. It escaped and ran down his face. I wanted to cry too, but I couldn't manage more than one tear at a time. I'd cried a bucketful of tears when he got arrested, when he went to court, when he finally took the plea bargain and got sentenced to prison. I cried every time I visited him. There were tears of joy when he got out and started his new life. But then I cried again when he started drinking again and hiding it from me. I cried relief when he called, saying that he was going back to jail for a month, drinking again and getting caught. His parole officer was getting tired of his excuses, of him crawling inside the bottle again. At least in jail, I'd know where he was at, and that he was safe. Not passed out in some alley, or maybe beaten and robbed, left for dead. My gut twisted with the idea of me being grateful he was in jail. It was part of all this craziness. We'd all known that that drinking path could lead, and where that fork in the road would be, where he would decide he'd become sober or not. There was that time he asked me to come to the AA meeting so I'd know more about him and why alcohol kept calling him. We had a good talk, like we sometimes do, getting into it, going deep inside of ourselves, me trying to dig out the poison that festered inside of him, the wound that did not heal. I was a cheerleader, pouring on the love. Part of me didn't think it was too hard. Go to work, stay sober, check in once a month with your parole officer. But it was. It's the hardest thing I can ever do, my son told me. I just can't say no, and I go find the booze and drink. It makes me feel good. Makes me forget how bad of a person I really am. I'd give him a hug and tell him how much I loved him, but he still drank. He still kept going back to jail. I didn't hear from him for a couple of months after that, and I feared the worst. And then his parole officer called me again, telling me there was a warrant out for him, that he'd been drinking again and not reporting like he needed to do. There was that craziness again, eating into my gut. The visiting room was loud, filled with 50 conversations, stool seats squeaking, children noisy, not knowing how to act in this place. Not that anyone else knew how to act here. My son kept looking away from me, drifting into one-syllable responses to my questions. I'm so ashamed you're seeing me like this, he said. I'm such a piece of crap. Why did you even bother with me? I put my hand on the glass, flattening it out. He put his hand up there too, his hand a perfect match with mine. We could almost touch each other. Almost, but not enough. A tear ran down my face, matched by his face. Static filled the phone receiver, and we just looked at each other. I love you, I finally said. My voice choked on my words. I had so much more to say, but I couldn't find the words. He nodded, another tear running down his face. I know you do, he said. I just don't deserve it. Yeah, you do, I said. You deserve to love yourself too. We'll see, he said. I'll work on it. Just believe in yourself, son, I said. I believe in you. He nodded. More tears. Our hands were still flat against the glass. We hung up the phones and just looked into each other's souls until the buzzer sounded. Thank you.
You've been listening to Prison Pipeline on KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Listen to this and previous Prison Pipeline programs at kboo.fm/prisonpipeline. Like Prison Pipeline on Facebook. I want to thank Carol Imani for organizing With You on the Journey, Director Chris Karsmar, Assistant Director Melissa Schmitz, and all the participants of With You on the Journey. Stay connected to With You on the Journey at facebook.com/withyouonthejourney, which is all one word. I will post notifications of when the next segments of With You on the Journey will air on that page. You can also find Carol Imani's email address there. If you have questions about the project or would like to share your stories as a family member of someone in prison, be in touch with her. Again, that's facebook.com/withyouonthejourney. The next segment of the show shares stories from mothers of people in prison. Thank you to our engineers, Danielle and Mike, and you, dear listener, for tuning in. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Halloween Community Rally and the Spirit of Unity on Saturday, October 31st at Waterfront Park in Portland. In the Spirit of Unity will be a family-friendly rally to raise the minimum wage, defend workers' rights, demand renters' rights, and support immigrants' rights. There will be trick-or-treating, costume contests, games, prizes, and music by Portland hip-hop artists. Again, that's In the Spirit of Unity, a Halloween community rally on Saturday, October 31st from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. at Waterfront Park, just south of the Hawthorne Bridge in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio presents Evil, Cruel Thing Attacking Humanity and Controlled by the Super Rich versus You and Me. This will be an evening on ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. This film and talk will take place on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater here in Portland. Learn about how this huge secret political entity, ALEC, creates legislation to keep wages low, to fill prisons. It bankrupts schools and poisons the air, land, and water. Union reps, teachers, activists, journalists, and others will join moderator and KBOO news director, Jenka Soderberg, in a panel discussion on People versus ALEC. Again, that's a film and talk to learn about ALEC on Thursday, November 12th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. And more information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It's 7 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's Hard Knock Radio.